No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm joined by my fellas, John Hodge and JC Abbott. Guys, it's been a minute, but great to be back on with you. And I don't know if everybody will get this reference, but I'm not going to start the show by asking, how was your day today, John Hodge? How was your day today, JC? How was your day today? Was it a good day or a bad day? That's probably over your heads, but it was from Seinfeld. When Kramer talks about these cliche questions that we ask all the time, like, you guys got to start the show with some fire, okay? Hodge, I liked what you did. Welcome, welcome, welcome in your own way. But then you're asking JC, oh, I hope you're having a good day today, JC. Like, isn't that a given? Boys, I hope every single day both of you wake up with fire in your belly and have the best day possible. It's sunny, blue skies in Toronto, where I'm taping this podcast, fellas. I'm not going to say how was your day, but how was it without me on the podcast? It felt like it was lacking a little bit of energy.
I do sometimes wake up with fire in the belly, but it depends on how much Taco Bell I've had the day before. I'll put it that way.
Wait, is that in the belly or going the other direction?
I will not answer that question. That is a question I'm not answering, Mr. Dunk. I thought our pods had lots of energy. We have, of course, missed you. But as for the Seinfeld reference, I'm not against the Seinfeld references. I just want it on the record that Justin has only ever seen one television show and then insists that it's the best show ever. And it's like, dude, you've watched one show. You can't watch one show and then crown it. That's ridiculous.
And you know that reference is going right over my head because when did Seinfeld end? It might have been before I was born.
Probably.
I think it ended in 1998.
Okay, so I was 1 year old when Seinfeld ended. That's how much you're dating yourself with that reference there, Doug. But you've seen me wake up in the morning. There's no fire in the belly. I'm barely coherent. I got to struggle out of bed. I'm fired up at night. Let's record the podcast at midnight Eastern time. That would be more in my wheelhouse.
Bro, I'll be asleep if that happens.
For the record, Seinfeld did in fact end in 1998. Though between the three of us, I do think that we fit the archetypes of those characters decently well. We need an Elaine, obviously. But Dunk is the everyday questioner. What's the deal? And then I could be like the prickly, neurotic one. Well, Jack, they're doing this. And then JC can walk into the apartment and go, oh, the draft, right? Like Kramer, you know? I think it could work.
You nailed that, bro.
I've seen the show, not the whole thing, but I've seen episodes. And to be honest, I think it's just okay. I think it's fine. I don't think it's bad. It just doesn't do a lot for me, but yeah, it's decent.
Fair. And I can acknowledge it. That's really the only series that I've watched start to finish. Other than, you know, House of Cards comes to mind, but I don't think it had the cachet and didn't run as long as Seinfeld. And the thing that I love about Seinfeld, is so many of those conversations in the episode stand the test of time, or have so far stood the test of time. Now, let's see what happens with AI and robots and all the stuff that might take over our world here. That's conversation for another day, but that's the reason I love it so much.
I think that eventually there'll be an AI filter where people will be able to take our podcast, plug it into something, and then it'll turn us into the three Seinfeld's characters talking about the CFL. It'll happen. And it's probably gonna be like 2027. It's not even that far away.
Oh, I'm here for it. I'm here for the podcast too, fellas. So let's get it rolling. Today, we're discussing the hellacious headshot delivered to Ottawa Red Blacks quarterback Drew Brown.
Some awards predictions following the first third of the 2025 CFL season.
Which CFL team is in the most trouble without their starting quarterback?
Which Canadian Football League team has the best shot at capturing first place in the rough and tumble West Division?
And a potential quarterback controversy in Edmonton. But first,
the CFL reinstated veteran defensive lineman Sean Lemon this past week after he was suspended for most of the 2024 season for gambling on games as a member of the Calgary Stampeders in 2021, including one in which he played. The 36-year-old immediately signed with the Alouettes and will be able to make his season debut in Week 9 after serving a 2-game suspension for testing positive for a banned substance. Hodge, did the CFL make the right decision in reinstating Lemon?
Yes, and I'm frankly surprised that this has been so controversial. There's a lot of people on social media who seem to think that Sean Lemon should be thrown into the ocean or like tarred and feathered in the public square. And look, we've been critical of Sean Lemon on this show. I think Sean is a smart guy. I think what he did was really stupid, and I think Sean would agree with that. And I did like his statement. He did say, and this is partially quoted from the statement, "I'm grateful for the opportunity to continue my career. I've learned a valuable lesson and look forward to being a positive influence in the locker room and throughout this amazing country," close quote. That's not an apology, but it is at least an admission that he did something wrong. And I think that if this is the standard moving forward, right, we all knew this was coming. Every league in North America has had problems with players or coaches or other people gambling. We can't have it, right? It needs to be penalized. That being said, I don't think that gambling on a game should automatically be some type of lifetime sentence. I think that this is a good precedent. This is a good standard. If you bet on games, it's a year. And if you have a second infraction, it's a lifetime ban. The only exception I would say is if you bet on your team to lose, or there is a distinct match fixing element to whatever it is you're doing, as we've seen recently as just a couple years ago in the NBA, that should automatically be a lifetime ban. Well, that is not what Sean Lemon did. He did bet on a game in which he played, but he was betting on his own team. Obviously, that's wrong. Nobody's saying that's right. But he also served the longest suspension in CFL history, right? He has had the harshest punishment ever levied by this league for doing that. I think that if you bet on your team, it's a year. If you bet against your team, it's a lifetime. And to me, this is a good standard moving forward. I know on this podcast, we often like to give hot takes. This is a perfect example of something. I thought that the league did great, and I'm surprised that there's been pushback.
I'm completely on the same page as you, Hodge. I've been as critical as anyone about Sean Lemon and what he did to deserve this suspension, but it was never death penalty level, right? And I think this punishment was consistent with what other leagues have done. The NFL has actually codified it now to this point where that first infraction, as long as it's not match fixing, is that year-long suspension rather than using the indefinite language that the CFL utilized in this case. But it was absolutely fair to suspend Lemon for this long, and it's fair to let him back in. To me, the interesting thing is just how eager the Montreal Alouettes were to get him back in their lineup. And we all know that Sean Lemon has stood the test of time. He remains incredibly productive, but we're talking about a guy who is going to be 37 next month and has now been out of football for an entire year. I think you can dismiss that when a guy is a little younger. When you're a little bit older, that becomes more difficult to absorb that type of extended absence. I'm going to be really interested to see what sort of impact Lemon can have on what is a very talented Montreal defense with some young pieces that are getting playing time there. I don't know if long-term his addition is actually the best move for that franchise.
I think you guys said it very well, and I'll agree with you, which makes for boring podcast content, but the CFL got this right. And I don't understand the hot takes out there. People saying that in other leagues, if Sean Lemon had done this, he would be banned for life. Like, do just a little bit of research. Look at, as Hodge astutely referenced, the NFL and what they're doing. The NBA, the NHL had a player that was suspended for 41 games and came back for betting. So I felt like this balance was correct between Randy Ambrosi and then Stuart Johnston reinstating Sean Lemon. And he had to go through a series of checkboxes, let's call them, to actually be reinstated. So I totally agree with the CFL's decision here to bring him back. And he's going to have to prove, as JC alluded to, that he can still get it done at 36 going on 37, which he turns, I believe it's on August 25th, if I have that day right. Let me just check here. Yes, August 25th. So let's see what he can do with the Montreal Alouettes. He was a key piece to that Grey Cup championship team in 2023, but he's been out of football, as JC alluded to. That said, he has shown that he can continue to get after the quarterback well into his 30s, you know, closing in on his 40s, but he's going to have to prove it once again.
Well, and it's something that we recently saw with the canceled season in 2020, right? Some older players came back from that year and they found a new gear. It was like, wow, a year off to rest the body, get it right. This has extended your career. And some guys came back from that and it was like, oh, you're done. Like, you don't have any more gas left in the tank. So I'm hesitant to say that a year off at this point of Sean Lemon's career is a positive or a negative. I think it has the possibility to be both. I know Lemon, when speaking to the media in Montreal, said he's in great shape, said he's been working out. So if that is true and he's been putting in the work in the gym, then maybe it'll be an advantage, but it's hard to say. We won't know until the proof is in the pudding. That being said, I do think he could be a nice boost to the Alouettes. Sean Lemon might not be an every down player at this point of his career. He doesn't have to be, right? He has to be that guy who comes in on second and eight and disrupts the quarterback, whether it's a sack, a pressure, a hurry, or whatever. That's his job, and that is a very, very valuable job in the CFL, as edge rushers who can disrupt and get to the quarterback. So we'll see. We'll see what Lemon's able to do. But I thought, again, just like you guys agreed, the league got this right. I don't think we need to talk about this anymore. Week six was not kind to CFL quarterbacks. Like, I think that's even understating it. It was terrible to CFL quarterbacks. Ottawa Redblacks quarterback Drew Brown was knocked out of his team's 30-15 loss to the Hamilton Tiger Cats after defensive back Deshaun Amos caught his face mask on a blitz. Winnipeg Blue Bombers QB Zach Kolaris was knocked out of his team's 41-20 loss to Calgary Stampeders when Clarence Hicks delivered a chest shot which caused the passer's helmet to bounce off the turf. Finally, the Montreal Alouettes have officially placed Davis Alexander on the 6-game injured list after he appeared to re-aggravate the hamstring injury he suffered earlier this year in his team's 26-25 come-from-behind win over the Toronto Argonauts. JC, which of these teams is in the most trouble without their starting QB?
It's the Ottawa Redblacks, without a question. I think if you go down this list, right, the Bombers are going to be a lesser team if Zach Kolaris misses time, but Chris Streveler has had success in one start this season, and I think they've got a pretty good roster around him. The Montreal Alouettes, we know how talented they are. McLeod Bethel-Thompson hasn't played up to snuff in his two starts this year, but we know that he's been successful as recently as last year as a starter. We expected a lot more from him. In start number three, perhaps he can get that going. In Ottawa, they have no margin for error with their 1-6 record. And I just don't think that they have the guy in behind Drew Brown to get it done. Dustin Crum has not looked good in any game where he's had to throw the football. In their one victory, he didn't really have to do that because it was in a torrential downpour and he could just use his legs to grind out a victory. That's not going to be the case every single week. And I think the Ottawa Redblacks are really going to struggle if Drew Brown misses any more time. And it's unfortunate because of all of these situations, that's the hit that was the most egregious, right? And I know there's a lot of CFL player or CFL fans out there who took issue with Deshaun Amos on that hit to the head and said he should have been ejected. And frankly, I have a hard time disagreeing with them. I don't think there was an intent to injure. I don't think it was the most egregious hit I've ever seen, but it was clearly crown of the helmet to Drew Brown's face mask. It was with no mitigating factors. He was free off the edge. Nobody was ducking. There was nobody blocking him. He could have very easily lowered his point of contact and delivered a clean shot to Drew Brown. Instead, he came in high. And I think there have to be serious consequences for that when it happens, to ensure that it doesn't happen again, because we cannot have quarterbacks being put at risk to that degree in this league when we know how important quarterback play is. Now, Drew Brown should have probably done up his helmet, and maybe that would have lessened the impact of the hit. But even in that case, I think Deshaun Amos came in way too high, and the CFL needs to come down hard with their supplemental discipline in terms of what type of fine that they are going to lay for that blow.
Bob Dice called for an ejection with TSN. He added it in his sideline interview with Claire Hanna, and I can understand that perspective, but let's provide a little balance here, okay? Because you know, we all know the bullets are flying fast and furious out there. You know, I do think there's a player safety element here, but at the end of the day, like, we're playing football. It's a contact sport. And if Drew Brown moves an inch to his left or an inch to his right, it's a different kind of a hit. And that's what Amos is trying to do in terms of sizing him up, coming off the edge on a blitz, you know, almost at full speed. I get it. We want to protect the quarterbacks. Yes, we have to do that. But then it just creates this bigger conversation that I just can't comprehend about, well, why isn't the CFL protecting its quarterbacks? I think the CFL has done a pretty good job within the rules of trying to do that. Like, the strike zone on a quarterback now is so small. And you even have some of these ticky-tack quarterback hits, and I'm saying that as a former university quarterback in this country, that are being called as roughing the passer. Like, let's go back to the 2000s and look at some of those hits that were not being called and that were being viewed as okay in the game. I get there's an evolution just like everything else in our world, but at some point we're still playing football. I do think that Amos needs to lower the crown of his helmet, but I don't think there was intent there. So to go suspend a guy without the intent of trying to go directly at somebody's head, to me, that might set a dangerous precedent, because I just think the strike zone for these quarterbacks now is so small. Do we need the best quarterbacks on the field? Yes. Are the Ottawa Redblacks a less fun team to watch without Drew Brown at quarterback? Yes. But ultimately, we're playing football. It's a contact sport. I can understand Dice's frustration, but this is where I always find it intriguing when you get a coach's real perspective, which that clearly was, because Dice was in the moment, is what if that was the opposing team's quarterback? What if that was a Darius Pickett blowing up Bo Levi Mitchell? Would Dice be saying that Pickett needs to be ejected? I highly doubt it, but that's where there needs to be balance, and I hope that's part of the discussion with this situation and going forward about some of these hits that occur within the game of football.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit before I let Hodge jump in. I don't think anyone's calling for a suspension, but we live in a world now, especially when you look at college football, where targeting is a thing, right? Automatic ejections for hit to the heads. And I think by any definition in college football, in the world that we live in now, that would have been an ejection at that level. And I think that is what concerns fans when they see that. It doesn't have to trickle down to the next game. We all know that people make mistakes and that plays are being made fast, but an action in a game like that that impacts the actual game that's being played needs to go both ways. And I think Deshaun Abo should have probably been thrown out. For the record, I'll read from the CFL rulebook here to provide the context of why he may not have been or what the referees are considering. He was given a grade 2 roughing the passer penalty. For that, it's when a blow is delivered with the crown of the helmet to the head or neck of the passer, which it was, when the defender has a clear view of contact, which he did, and there are no mitigating circumstances such as the QB's helmet level changing prior to contact. They checked every box there for the grade 2. Actions that rise it to the level of an ejection, according to the rulebook, are contact on the passer that is deemed a non-football action. I don't think that qualifies. It was a football play. Or an egregious example of a roughing the passer foul. And here's where we can debate it back and forth. Because what does egregious mean in this context? Clearly, the referees and the command center did not believe this qualified as egregious. I think a lot of fans disagree. I think the Ottawa Redblacks disagree. But that language there is very subjective, and that's the root of the conversation here.
That's very well laid out, my man. I totally respect that side of it. I'm not necessarily saying what I said is my opinion. I just think there needs to be some balance there. And I always think of this with the coaches. Like I said, if that was a Darius Pickett on Bo Levi Mitchell, would Bob Dice have been okay with Pickett being ejected? I think that's the way that it needs to be viewed. Ultimately, for the betterment of the league, we would like to have all the starting quarterbacks be healthy, but this is also why football operations and general managers and coaches get paid, is because you have to have that next man up ready to go. Dustin Crum's development as a passer simply has not happened, to get to more to answering Hodge's question. And I think the Redblacks are in trouble here if he continues to start football games, because he's shown what he is. I think if you're Ottawa, you got to bring Tyree Adams up from the practice squad and give him an opportunity. Matt Schultz has clearly played his way out of favor there with Tommy Condell. Their relationship goes back a number of years, but for Schultz to even be benched for Crum is a major deal there, just considering the relationship with Condell. And if Ottawa wants to start winning football games or even have a chance to do it, Tyree Adams is intriguing. To me, we saw a little glimpse of it before he had that major injury. So I think that's probably the way to go before you start talking about potentially bringing in free agent quarterbacks, because at least Adams has been there in the building and should be somewhat familiar with the offense.
Personally, I think the CFL called this one right as well. I don't think it was egregious. I think it was a 25-yard penalty. And by the way, thank you, JC, for looking at the CFL's rulebook, because rules should be decided during the offseason by the rules committee, and then the officials get a chance to study those rules so they can call the game accurately, right? I think there's a lot of people who, whether it's Redblacks fans, Redblacks themselves, or others, right, we get so emotional during the season. It's like, well, that should have been a lifetime suspension. That should have been a 50-yard penalty. And it's like, the officials' jobs is not to make SHIT up. That is not their job. Their job is to have a rule book, memorize it, and then accurately call the game. It is not their job to get emotionally invested and then say, well, I know the rule says it's only a 10-yard penalty, but I'm going to give you 40 yards because that was terrible. Like, no, that is the officials injecting themselves into a role that is not theirs. And we do not want officials to do that. We need the rules to be called as the league and its member clubs see fit by way of the rules committee. So the rules are set, then the officials call them. The officials did that. Did I like the hit? No. I think that, and I think, Justin, you made a great point with the strike zone of the quarterback. You're not allowed to hit above the shoulders or below the knee. I don't know why so many defenders then say, well, my goal is to hit you an inch below your helmet, right? My goal is to hit you on your upper chest. And I appreciate that part of the play, right, is you're trying to blow up the quarterback and cause a fumble. Or if the quarterback has started the throwing motion, like, disrupt that. But to me, you can do that just as well by putting your shoulder pad on the quarterback's belly button. And guess what? If he ducks his helmet 2 inches before impact, then you're not at risk of a penalty, right? Because if you take a penalty, not only does the play not count anymore, but you're giving up 15 or 25 yards for the flag. Like, yeah, you want the opportunity to turn what is a sack into a forced fumble and a takeaway, maybe even a return touchdown, something like that. But by doing that with a high hit, you're also adding to the possibility or the probability of the play being negated by penalties. So to me, that's something I don't know why CFL defensive coaches don't teach more is, hey, put your shoulder pad on the belly button. That way you've got leeway up, you've got leeway down. But I know that there's lots of coaches in the CFL who are a lot smarter than me when it comes to coaching defense. So if anybody is listening to the show, hit me up. I would love to know how you teach this and why it's not taught differently. I'm asking the question. And I don't think any teams make their position coaches available to the media anyway. So I can't actually talk to a lot of you on the record if I want to. But that's my take. As for the actual question, which team is the most screwed? I'm going to say it's the Montreal Alouettes. And I'm going to say it for this reason. The Ottawa Redblacks won a game with Dustin Crum. The Winnipeg Blue Bombers won a game with Chris Streveler. The Alouettes ain't won jack with McLeod Bethel-Thompson. McLeod Bethel-Thompson has been a good quarterback in this league. Frankly, I was shocked at how poorly he played through two starts this season. But had he not played the way he did, I question if the Alouettes would have brought Davis Alexander back as quickly as they did. Right? If he had lit up this, you know, those two opponents, if the Alouettes are 5-0 after five games, do they really rush Davis Alexander back to play the Toronto Argonauts with no Chad Kelly? Like, I'm not convinced the answer is yes. I'm obviously speculating, but I'm not convinced the answer is yes. So to me, I appreciate the standings are what they are, but the Redblacks haven't won a game with Drew Brown, right? The Bombers have lost two games with Zach Collaros. The Alouettes, at least, they're the only team that hasn't won a game without their starter yet. So that's why I think they're the team that's potentially the hardest up.
You make a fair point there, Hodge, but if the Montreal Alouettes and go out and lose the next three games, it's not a crisis mode for that franchise, right? They still have the opportunity to come back. They've got a talented roster. They've built themselves a lot of goodwill in that city. I will say the other thing that came out of this Drew Brown hit is when we have a controversial incident like this and the coaches might say something in the post game, I end up having to listen to the local post game show to get the comments from the locker room. And I don't know that I've ever heard a fan base so angry and checked out and apathetic as the Ottawa Redblacks were. On that occasion, multiple people called into that show saying, I've been following Ottawa football for 60 years and I am done after today. I am no longer watching. See you next year or never again. Like, that is the situation they are dealing with in Ottawa, is their core base of fans no longer want to show up to the stadium. They only had 15,000 people there for that game after, you know, developing a really strong atmosphere and strong fan base in the early goings of that new franchise. It's all been eroded. They have no room for error at this point if they want to keep fans engaged. That's the unfortunate reality. And if you don't have Drew Brown, you run out of a lot of options. So I don't think it can be anyone other than Ottawa just because of that context.
I will say this, and credit to the fans, they deserve to be frustrated. But when people say, I've done this for 60 years and I'm done, that sounds a lot like me being like, I'm done with the McDonald's drive-thru. I'm never going through again. And then 3 days later, it's like, oh, damn, that's right. I said that thing. So I'm a little skeptical. That's all I'm saying. Of those
McDonald's,
people. They're going to keep supporting.
It's like a hamburger restaurant. You go and they give you like fast food. I don't know if you've ever been there.
I'm barfing in my mouth.
Have you ever eaten a McDonald's, Justin? Ever?
I have when I was a kid, but I can't remember the last time I ate there. It was probably like a Happy Meal when I was like 7 or something.
Okay. Fair enough.
Dunk is not a real human. He is an automaton that runs on quinoa.
And kale. Don't forget kale. Hodge, though, you brought up a great point about the Montreal Alouettes. Would they even be in the situation where Davis Alexander could potentially be out longer term? Like Jason Moss's comments, to me, you know, didn't really make sense. Like, he's your franchise guy. You're going to get asked about him, okay? And the CFL likes to call itself the most accessible league on the planet, perhaps, or the most accessible league in North America, let's say, and Jason Moss is out here saying, don't ask me about my starting quarterback. It's like, bro, that's your franchise. You know, that's the guy that has tied a CFL record by going 8-0 to start his career. Like, why once a week can you not answer a question about his update? Like, not only do the media want to know, but more importantly, the fans want to know. And ultimately, the fans, in a roundabout way, pay your salary. So I don't get what the big deal is. Just answer the question, man. But did the Alouettes rush him back too early? I think Hodges' point is bang on. It appears that is the case. Do you want to have him on the field? Yes. Does Davis Alexander want to play? Yes. But it seems like he came back too early because, guys, even early in that football game, he didn't look 100%. Now, I'm not saying within an 18 regular season game regular season that you're going to get all the way back to 100%. But he looked much less than 100% favoring that leg where he has the issue.
Well, and local reporter Pablo Herrera Vargara, who does great work for us at Three Down Nation, was messaging all through the game. Like he sees Davis practice on a regular basis. And he was texting us during the game. He's like, Davis does not look 100%. Like Davis does not look 100%. He looks like, and then lo and behold, albeit a game-winning touchdown, great play by Davis Alexander, but he pulls on the hammy and it's like, well, we might be back to square one with this rehabilitation that maybe was supposed to take 6 weeks the first time. They rushed him back after three and a half. So anyway, and look, the Alouettes, yeah, they're 4-2. They can afford to lose some games. I guess what I'm saying more so is they have a chance with the current situation in the East Division to push for first place. They might be sunk. The Red Blacks are 1-6. They might have been sunk regardless of who's under center. I think the Alouettes might have the most to lose.
If you're the Alouettes, do you start James Morgan at quarterback over McLeod Bethel Thompson?
No, you start McLeod with a short leash, in my opinion.
Also, Caleb Evans is there. Like, and
Caleb Evans looked great in the preseason. I know it's preseason.
I know he's struggled at times when given starts, but he's still a guy who has won games in the CFL, who was ahead of Davis Alexander on the depth chart last year. Like, I don't think you're leapfrogging him for any reason. Like, let's give Caleb Evans some respect here.
Good point, mustache man.
We are officially one third of the way through the 2025 CFL regular season, which means it's time to start considering which players are the front runners for major end of season awards. Dunk, if you had to pick today, who would you vote for MOP?
You know, at first I thought this could be a difficult decision, but based on the first six games, it has to be. Has to be. Kenny Lawler, the human highlight machine. Like, all due respect to Bo Levi Mitchell, I know you threw for over 5,400 yards last season. You're killing it this year. But Kenny Lawler has taken this offense to a new level. He has been spectacular. His 8 touchdown catches in 6 games, fellas, averaging over 100 yards a game while being, oh, by the way, I think people need to remember this, the focal point for defenses game in and game out in terms of game planning for this dude. It doesn't matter if there's 2 guys on him. He still outjumps them, goes up above the rim, and dunks on people time and time again. This guy is the odds-on favorite to be the MOP. If he even comes off his pace a little bit, I think he can still win it. Most importantly, like everything else we're going to talk about in this discussion, guys got to stay healthy. Kenny Lawler is doing it so far through 6 games. If he puts it together, you know, most of the rest of the regular season, I think Lawler could be the first receiver to win MOP since what? G-Roy Simon?
I think G-Roy was the last one to do it. Was that 20? Was it 2006?
That's what I wanted to say,
well,
too.
Brandon Banks wanted it in 02.
Brandon Banks, guys.
Oh, true.
Oh,
Banks
true.
Wanted it in 19.
Whoops.
I still think of Banks as a returner, but yes, he did it largely for what he did as a receiver in 19. So I think those are the 3 this century. It's Milt in 02,
Chad 06,
G Wright, and then 19.
Chad Owens,
Chad
too,
Owens
yeah.
in 12.
2012.
Fair. Again, a receiver returner kind of hybrid, but fair enough. So it has happened 4 times if we're not missing anybody else, and I can keep stop putting my foot in my mouth. But no, I think Kenny Lawler's the pick for MLP. To me, the obvious second choice is Bolivar Mitchell, which is why we need to change the way that these awards are done. If the two best players for an award are on the same team or in the same division, that should matter. I think the West Division nominee would be Trevor Harris or VA. I can go either way on that one, but regardless, the top pick should be Kenny Lawler, and the second pick should be Bolivar Mitchell. Mm-hmm. Most outstanding defensive player. And by the way, I've gone through all these awards, so I'm going to just throw out some names. Jalen Hutchings, defensive lineman for the Calgary Stampeders. Basically a rookie. He played a couple of games last year, so he's not eligible for most outstanding rookie. But a guy who's been an absolute game wrecker, 4 sacks for them in 6 games, an unbelievable player in the run. I think two guys who stand out on top of that are Darius Pickett and Derek Moncrief, both strong side linebackers for Ottawa and Calgary, respectively. But Hutchings is my pick a third of the way through the season. Obviously, we're only a third. These things can change. Most outstanding Canadian is Nathan Rourke. 10 touchdowns, 4 picks. You can't really argue with that. Some guys who I would give some props to, Nick Dembski, Isaac Adeyemi-Berglund, Kevin Mattel, Adrian Green, who's been really good on the corner for the Stamps. I also think Tyson Philpott. Most outstanding offensive lineman, if I had to give it today, maybe Jamarcus Hardrick, right tackle in Saskatchewan. But guys who I think are right there, Logan Ferland, who's been at center for the Riders, Zach Williams, who I think has been great at guard for the Stamps, Brandon Revenberg, who honestly has been an honorable mention or a runner-up for this award so many times. I think we just give him one. Just I feel bad that he's never won one. Most outstanding special teams player, I think, is Isaiah Wooden, Hamilton Tiger Cats. Some people who I think deserve a nod, though. Mark Leggio and Sean White are both perfect on their field goals. And Sergio Castillo has been very good in Winnipeg. 58-yarder was no joke this past week. And then most outstanding rookie. I love the love for Damian Alford. I think it could be him. I think Derek Sluka, safety in Toronto, has been excellent as well. Travis Tice, I think, has been very good in Montreal. Christopher Fortin, first-round pick out of UConn, who's been at center for the Stampeders. He's been excellent. And then I also think that Matthew Peterson in Winnipeg, though his numbers will fall, obviously, as Brady Oliveira gets the starts, but he was great through the first third of the season when called upon. So those are my picks. And in case people yell at me, players who are ineligible for most outstanding rookie because they played games last year include Mario Kendricks, who's been great for Hamilton on their D-line, Andrew Chatfield in Toronto, who leads the CFL in sacks, and Hutchings, as mentioned. So some guys who you think of as rookies, not actually eligible for most outstanding rookie, but those are my picks. And I'm curious to hear what people think about that.
I think you've nailed it basically across the board here, Hodge. I'd push back on some of your honorable mentions, as it were, but basically none of your selections. I really like the pick of Jalen Hutchings as most outstanding defensive player to this point in the season. I don't know that he's getting enough love across the board from CFL fans because he plays in the interior and yeah, he has 4 sacks, but it's not exactly crazy numbers yet at this point. But this guy is basically noticeable every single snap he plays. He demands double teams. He's penetrating in the run game. He's opening up sacks for other players on that Calgary D line because he's twisting or spiking, and he's demanding so much attention. He's a player that probably should be in the NFL right now if he hadn't gotten hurt his senior year at Texas Tech. He's a physical freak. I don't think he is long for the CFL, and we should really be enjoying him and lauding him while we have him because he has been sensational. I also think another Calgary player that deserves more love maybe isn't going to be out a guy like Garrett Sluka or Damian Alford because he won't have stats for people to look at. But Christopher Fortin at center for the Stampeders has been a revelation, right? What a sensational draft pick by that Stampeders staff at 8th overall. He should have never fallen that far. I think moving him from guard to center has been a great move. He's been solid. He's making the calls for what might be the best offensive line in the CFL right now. Really stout, getting the job done in the run game. He has been plug and play. And at a position as difficult mentally for a rookie at center, that's super impressive.
I really want to note Hutchings because, you know, you hear big name guys get moved in the offseason, namely Mike Rose being released by the Calgary Stampeders. Fans freak out, right? But sometimes, and the majority of the time, quite honestly, if not all the time, teams have somebody waiting in the wings that's shown flashes here or there that they believe can have a season like Hutchings or can at least fill in that role, perhaps not to the level of Mike Rose. And I don't think Hutchings has performed to a level that anybody expected him to, because I think it's way above what anybody in Calgary probably expected. But these are some of the moves that happen. I think we need to give credit to the Calgary front office. Dave Dickinson is the head coach and general manager there. Brendan Mahoney, the assistant general manager there, played a role in this decision with Hutchings because he did show a little bit at the end of last season. And now they've been proven to be right, at least through six games in this season, with what they've done, you know, especially on defense, turning it over. Literally, there's 12 new starters over there. But in particular, releasing Mike Rose to give Hutchings that opportunity to start in the middle. Without releasing Rose, we have no idea potentially what Hutchings can do, or perhaps he's just a rotational guy. So I think that really needs to be pointed out here. And when these moves happen, next offseason, big names released at a certain position, there is a likelihood that the team probably has a plan. Do the fans like it if it's a known name like Mike Rose in Calgary? Probably not. He ended up in Saskatchewan. He, too, is having a pretty good season himself. Not quite as good as Hutchings, but I think it's worth noting.
No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Calgary Stampeders and Saskatchewan Roughriders have pulled away from the pack in the West Division. Both sit at 5-1 through six games. The two teams meet again in Week 12 when they play for the second and final time at McMahon Stadium. If you had to project at this current moment in time, fellas, which team will finish first in the West Division?
It's the Calgary Stampeders, and that's no discredit to the Roughriders. They're 5-1. They've had a very good season. I picked them to lose in BC this week, and they played a great football game in all three phases. So credit to them, not taking anything away. But the Stampeders, over the last 3 weeks, I said something to the effect of this 2 weeks ago. I'm going to double down on it. This three-game run that the Stampeders have been on is maybe the most impressive three-game run by any CFL team since the pandemic. Like, they host the Bombers and mollywop them, 21-point home win. They go into Regina, have to play a day late because of smoke, and they win by double digits again. And then, on a relatively short week, 5 days of rest, they have to travel again, this time going into Winnipeg on an emotional night at Princess Auto Stadium, sold-out crowd. And yeah, the game was close when Zach Kolaris went down, but still, they take full. It was a clean hit that knocked Zach out of that game, and they take full advantage. 21-point, like, this team has beaten the Blue Bombers by 42 combined points in two meetings this season. That is unbelievable. And when you look at the rest of that schedule, they've got three games against Edmonton left. I think right now that's looking like three dubs. They get Montreal this week. Tough matchup, but again, no Davis Alexander. That makes it a lot easier. And through the rest of the season, they've only got one more game against Saskatchewan. Guess what? They're plus 14 on the point differential. They got a great chance to get that season series. and they only have to play Hamilton one more time, and they only have to play Winnipeg one more time. Like, the strength of their schedule is not strong at all. Like, they've had the toughest third of their season already, and they're 5-1. And another crazy stat, I pulled this yesterday as I was going through my notes. The Stampeders have yet to be favored in a game this year. They're 5-1. They have not been favored in a game this year. Also, the only quarterback to beat them is Dustin Crum, which is another insane stat, but whatever. Maybe he's their Crump tonight. I don't know. But regardless.
Crump tonight.
Sorry, I watched that Superman movie. It was pretty good. The Stampeders are the number one team in the West Division. To me, I think that's where they'll finish. Again, it's early in the season. Lots can happen. But right now, I don't think you can make an argument against that. They're the favorite to win the West Division.
I, too, watched that Superman movie, but it was just Vern Adams Jr. doing a spinorama before throwing it up to Damien Alford for a deep touchdown. I think that counts, play. Right? No, I think there's a ton of credit that needs to be given to the Calgary Stampeders front office. I mean, we've sat on this podcast for the last number of years as that franchise slowly declined, and we've thrown shots at them for a lack of change, a failure to bring in talent, all these different things. And Dave Dickinson, to his credit, made some very controversial moves this offseason, moving on from long-tenured coaches like Mark Killam and Brent Monson, making decisive player personnel moves and bringing in Vernon Adams Jr. and Falera Maromalade, and really changed the whole philosophy around that team, right? They went out and got talent. They found players. They were willing to upset the apple cart, as it were, in order to do something different. And it's worked, right? And it looks like it will continue to work. This doesn't seem like a fluke. It seems sustainable. So as much as we criticized Dickinson and that organization, they deserve a boatload of praise because they've done something I didn't think they could, which is change that dynamic without a change at head coach. They've done it. They're continuing to do it. And I think they are going to be the favorites, not just in the West Division, but in the CFL going forward, unless something happens to VA. They have the pieces, in my mind, to keep getting it done.
You know, in our last segment, fellas, we talked about end-of-year awards. Well, right now, Dave Dickinson has to be far and away the favorite for Coach of the Year in the Canadian Football League. If there was an award for General Manager of the Year, he would likely get that too, along with the other people who have helped him in the front office. I named Brendan Mahoney earlier as a key one of those. Cole
Huffnagle. How about Dwayne Cameron for just a second with what he's done in the draft, right? The last couple of years, two starters on that offensive line in the first round. Damien Alford at first overall, like the pieces, even of the depth of that roster has vastly improved. What a credit to him.
The CFL mind, draft doesn't matter crowd is shaking right now. Shaking.
And you know, don't get it twisted. John Huffnagle is still involved with his team. You know how I know that, fellas? He was down bright and early working out at Hotel Saskatchewan. I like to get my workouts in early. On game day. Now, that game was supposed to be played on Friday, so technically it wasn't game day. But anyway, on the Friday, the game was eventually played on the Saturday at a much earlier time. But he's still around this football team. So I think even we need to give some credit to John Huffnagle, because we know that he's still somewhat involved in the team to the degree I don't think the Calgary Stampeders or Dickinson really want to share. But, you know, he took some shots too, as this franchise was on the decline. Let's not forget, they haven't won a playoff game since the Grey Cup in 2018. It seems like this team could win a playoff game in 2025, and this reinvented roster has quite frankly been unbelievable, and that's why they are indeed the favorite to be first place in the West Division. I do think Saskatchewan is going to challenge them, though. When you break down that game, 24-10, it was kind of a tale of two halves. But really, the physicality from Calgary was what stood out to me. They dominated on both sides of the line of scrimmage. Corey Mace essentially said that, you know, his team got out-physical, got whooped, however you want to phrase it there. Saskatchewan knows they have to be better, and I think they can get to that level of physicality to compete with Calgary. But going into that game, A.J. Ouellette had been running strong. The Riders as a team and Ouellette as an individual were leading the league in rushing yards, and he's held to 6 carries for 9 yards. Now, on the flip side of it, in the second half, Trevor Harris comes out and throws for over 300 yards, which hasn't been done by a Rider quarterback since Kerry Joseph in 2006, by the way. And there were a couple of key third, I think it was 2 third and threes, actually, in that ball game where Corey Mace elected to go for it. And I'm only talking about this in hindsight, and I like the decisions to go for it, but if you kick a couple field goals there, then it's a one-possession game coming down the stretch, and maybe it looks a little different. I like the aggressiveness. I think it's a new approach. I still think it was the right decision to go for it. I'm just saying, you know, talking about that game in retrospect. So that game in week 12 at McMahon Stadium, excuse me, is going to be a great one. But I think right now the Stamps are the class of the division. They should be given their flowers. And I think that people need to understand that we were calling it how we saw it as the Stampeders were on a steady decline. As much as some people in the organization might not have wanted to have heard it, but now we are on the other side singing their praises because the team has done so well through 6 games. Let's not get it twisted, though. It's 6 games. 6 games does not a season make, and it doesn't win you a Grey Cup. But this team right now looks like the class of the Canadian Football League, and I think that needs to be spread far and wide because a lot of people were thinking this was Dave Dickinson potentially just going through the motions and being let go after a long run in Calgary at the end of the 2025 season. Well, Dave Dickinson is, you know, sticking up a middle finger to all of his haters and saying, nah, you thought I was done? I'll reinvent myself. I'm coming back with a vengeance. And this team looks to be for real. They got to keep proving it. But man, do they look really good.
Well, and I'll add one more thing to any members of the organization who thought we were harsh. And I agree, we weren't too harsh the last few years. But if you thought that and it made you work a little bit harder to get back to where you are now, you're welcome. You're welcome.
They're going to hate that, Hodge.
Well, they can feel however they want about it. They're inside of their feelings. But sometimes in life, you don't work as hard as you otherwise could until you get that pushback and it lights that fire, or in some case, relights that fire. So if the criticism, whether it's from us, others in the media, whatever, your own fans who, again, attendance has consistently dropped in Calgary, not I think last year was flat, but had dropped basically every year for 10 years previous to that, hey, the alarm bells were going off. You got it fixed. You're at the top of the West Division. Good for you. Mark Killam was non-committal regarding the status of Trey Ford, telling 880 Ched, quote, "We're just going to have to wait and see on that one," close quote, regarding the starting QB spot. Which quarterback should the Elks start this week, Ford or Cody Fajardo?
I think I'm going to ruffle some feathers here with my take on this, but it has to be Cody Fajardo. It has to be Cody Fajardo, guys. And we've given Trey Ford a long leash. We've sung his praises. We've demanded he be put in. And he hasn't answered the bell. And I know he was sort of trending in a positive direction before their last game, but I watched him against the BC Lions, and I wish I hadn't, because that was about as bad of a quarterback performance as I have ever seen in the CFL. 34 yards passing, gentlemen, and he basically didn't get pulled until the fourth quarter. That is egregious. It's indefensible. He was missing throws outright. And you just can't continue on that track when you're a team like Edmonton that is bleeding in terms of its reputation, in terms of trying to get fans in the stands and reinvigorate that city. They can't afford to have performances like that going forward. And frankly, even in the games that he played reasonably well in, Ford wasn't that spectacular. That perfect passer rating, I think it came on 17 attempts. You know, a bunch of that yardage came on a screen pass to Justin Rankin where he took it up the field. Another one was a deep shot that Javon Leak basically bailed him out in double coverage. Like, these are not the type, or this is not the type of production that great CFL quarterbacks necessarily rely on, right? And I think there needs to be a change. I don't ever think that Ford was a great fit for what Jordan McSimmick likes to do on offense. I think they are an awkward coupling. I don't know that anyone has done enough to maximize what he can do with his legs. And frankly, when I listen to him talk in the media, I don't hear a guy who is taking responsibility for his own failings, right? He feels like he's in a good place. He's trying to keep level-headed. I appreciate that might be his mindset, but you know, I just sat in front of Nathan Rourke on Saturday after he had a terrible game, and he put it all on him. He said, look, I'm not doing enough for this team. I lost us this game today. I don't hear that from Trey Ford right now. And a starting quarterback should be saying those types of things. I think from all perspectives, they need a fresh breath of air into that organization that Cody Fajardo might be able to provide, because they have too much talent across the board to be failing the way they are.
Let's get it right. Trey Ford terrible and Nathan Rourke terrible were much different games.
Oh, okay. Dramatically different. But I'm like, Nathan Rourke was terrible by his own standards. He still threw for over 300 yards, and he blamed the loss on him. Trey Ford's thrown for 34 yards, and then he comes back a week later, and he's telling the media, I actually think I'm in a good place, right? I'm just glad I saw the reads. Well, you didn't hit the reads. Maybe take some responsibility for that. Those comments really rubbed me the wrong way.
To me, the key with this football team last year during that run was the running game. Mm-hmm. And yes, Trey Ford was a quarterback, but I don't think he is yet or has proven to be a quarterback who can throw it 25, 30, 35, 40 times in a game and lead you to a win. The Elks need to commit to running the football. Justin Rankin had 3 carries against BC. Javon Leak had 2. Like Trey Ford, everybody knows this, helps you open up those seams a little wider in the RPO game for those running backs. To me, that's one of the major issues with the offense. So I understand the talk about potentially making a change at quarterback, but you need to at least play to Trey Ford's strengths a little more and your team's strengths, the offensive line firing off and running the football. Like, you have Rankin there who, by all accounts, the Elks love. Javon Leak's one of the fastest players in the Canadian Football League. We saw last year what he did in Saskatchewan with that breakout 3-touchdown game as a running back. Like, that was electric. To me, that's the foundation of this team. Run the football, be physical, play tough on defense with all the talent they have over there that is still coming together. And all due respect, I don't think it's been talked about enough that J.C. Sherritt is in his first year as a defensive coordinator. It's difficult when you're going up against the likes of, you know, for example, longtime offensive play callers in the league like a Buck Pierce. Like, that's a difficult situation. That is a major advantage for BC in that football game. Buck Pierce calling the offensive plays against J.C. Sherritt. He definitely has some learning to do. I'm not saying he can't get to that level, but these are some of the factors. Plus, you brought this whole team together. To me, I just think you got to stick to running the football. And, you know, we love to say in the CFL that in the last 3 minutes, the game can change, which is absolutely true. So just because you get behind by a couple touchdowns in a game doesn't mean you have to abandon the run game. You can go down the field, you know, pretty quickly, even just running the football because there's only 20 seconds on the play clock. So to me, that's where this starts. If you're going to make the decision to change quarterbacks, I get it. But I don't think that the Elks have committed to running the football, especially not the last time out in that 32-14 loss to the BC Lions. And that doesn't help Trey Ford, because when he's at his best, and I saw it live in person last year, when the Elks went into Mosaic Stadium 0-7 and put up over 40 points on a Riders defense that was tops in the league against the run. And a lot of that damage was done on the ground. That set up Trey Ford to take opportunities down the field in one-on-one coverage with deep balls that he connected on. He looked really good, I thought, in that game because they played to his strengths. I think that's what needs to happen here with Trey Ford. If you really want to find out who he is, play to his strengths, commit to running the football, and then let's see if he has another terrible game or two throwing it. I think you kind of need to see him through this, because if you change to Cody Fajardo now and he doesn't play well, because I don't think Fajardo has looked particularly great when he's come into the games, then what do? You've shattered Trey Ford's confidence. I think you got to give him a chance coming out of this bye week to rectify that terrible, and let's call it what it was. It was a terrible performance, 4-for-12 for 34 yards. You got to give him that chance to try to get it right, and if he can't for the next game or two, I think then you think about Cody Fajardo coming in. And I get, JC, your point about Nathan Rourke taking responsibility and Trey Ford feeling like he's in a good place, but you need to talk to yourself mentally and when the words come out of your mouth in a positive way. So I think there's a little bit of a different way he could have gone about it, but I actually like that approach where he's not dwelling on the last game and he feels comfortable. Perhaps we'll see that this week, but he might not even get the opportunity. Who knows? Maybe the ploy by Mark Killam is a way to make Trey Ford think that he's got to earn it in practice, right? If I'm non-committal on my quarterback status and not just giving you this job, because the Elks have given him that job with the contract he got and through the first number of games this season, that if he's got to earn it, maybe that sharpens Trey Ford.
To me, the answer is simple. It's Trey Ford's last shot. You get one more kid. Like you're starting in Saskatchewan this week. It's going to be a tough game. Then again, Trey Ford also won in Regina last year and played very well in that game. So this is your shot. And if you don't play well, we're going to Cody Fajardo the following week when the Tiger Cats come to town. And I say that because I think if you are Edmonton, a team that's struggling to sell tickets, that's fighting for relevancy in that market, I think that changing the quarterback for a home game is a way to maybe keep some of your fans on board. And I do agree that Trey Ford was miserable this past game. I also thought he was better than JC gave him credit for in the Ottawa win. He's fun to watch when he's on. Arguably the most fun player to watch in the CFL when he's on. The only adjustment that I would make, and Jordan Maximick has forgotten more about game planning than I know, but I would like to see the Elks get more creative in their run game. Well, but Steven Sorrells, who is the team's run game coordinator, is the same guy who was there last year when they were running the heck out of the football, number one rushing attack in the CFL. I want to see both running backs on the field at the same time. I want to see not just the RPO, not just the read option. I want to see triple option. Hell, throw in a quadruple option and hit whether it's Kayon Julian Grant. Like I want to see more creativity in the run game. I want to see Trey Ford set up for more success. You are not going to have success with Trey Ford if you ask him to drop back and stay in the pocket 35 times a game. That is not a recipe for success. It has never been a recipe for success with him. I want to see a stronger dedication running the football. I want to see them dress 7-0 linemen, Phil Grahovac on one side, Jackson Morgan on the other, couple of big old guys out of the OUA, go double tight, and then say, by the way, which one of you has better hands? Because one of you is catching a pass this week. Like, get creative, right? They say if you can't, what's the old saying? If you can't beat them with something, baffle them with BS, there's nothing wrong with running triple option and throwing passes to offensive linemen. If you can just baffle your opponent, you might be able to beat them. And no one is expecting Jackson Morgan or Phil Grahovac to catch a pass when they're lining up at tight end 20 times a game. They only have to leak out once, and that could be a touchdown for you guys in a red zone situation. So that is the type of adjustment I want to see for the Elks to set Trey Ford up for more success. You just had a bye week. Please tell me that you installed something new and Trey Ford friendly that can help you get a win in Ryderville, because their season is very quickly slipping away, because they don't have the advantage of a Toronto or an Ottawa where, well, we just have to be third place in our division. No, the Elks have to pass somebody in the West, and that opportunity is slipping by.
I did not have Hodge advocating for more Jackson Morgan receiving yards on my podcast bingo card. But apparently that's where we're at here.
Big man tutties. I want to see big man tutties. And the Saskatchewan Rough Riders are not spending part of the practice week going, what if Phil Grahovac
runs
a 5-yard out this week? Well, maybe. I don't know.
It worked
when the Bombers hit Tui Yeli. It worked when the Argos hit Ryan Hunter. I'm just saying. It's now time for a brand new segment on the podcast. By popular demand, This is JC's random neglister. Let's go.
Popular demand. We got like three or four comments that people want this segment. So I'll start off.
That's popular demand.
With a fun one, because I think this is going to create some buzz and really make this segment real. We'll go to the Saskatchewan Rough Riders.
Why can't Hodge introduce you properly with your new title that you have?
Which one? Which new title?
CGS.
Oh, I think he's talking about CGS.
Okay. Yes. Director of Canadian Scouting.
You can add some more legitimacy to this. Hodge, come on. Give the man a big welcome here.
We officially welcome the what's the title again?
Canadian. I don't director. Actually know what the official title. I'm just handling their Canadian Scouting. Canadian Scouting person.
Canadian Scouting Director.
Canadian Scouting Director. Come on, boys. Of the College Gridiron Showcase, a well-known college scouting event that takes place in Fort Worth, Texas, annually, which has not only a number of future NFL players, but also CFL players participating each year. Mr. Abbott, go ahead.
I'm going to start off with a fun one. I'm going to the Saskatchewan Rough Riders Neglist to get Rider Nation on my side. And if you've already scanned this, guys, you probably saw one player stick out above the rest because he had a unique school designation. I'm talking about receiver Deion Smith out of Holmes Community College. Now, why would the Saskatchewan Rough Riders be neglisting a JUCO player? I'll tell you why. Because Deion Smith, 6'4", 190, was one of the top high school receiver recruits in the nation. Four-star, ninth-rated receiver overall. Played six games at LSU as a true freshman. Littered up against Central Michigan. 11 catches, 186 yards, two TDs. The staff at LSU at the time in 2021 were saying he was their best future weapon, better than guys like Malik Nabers, who went in the first round of the NFL draft. But it all fell apart for academic reasons. He couldn't make eligibility. He had to go to the JUCO route after sitting out the 2022 season, littered up down there at Holmes with over 1,000 yards and 12 TDs in eight games, made himself the number one JUCO recruit in the country that season, committed to Ole Miss, but again, couldn't get it done academically, had to sit out last year. Now he's looking for a home. You're talking about a guy with NFL caliber potential, somebody who can sit out there on the outside like a Kenny Lawler and beat people one-on-one with jump balls, make 50-50 balls, 80-20 balls in his favor. And the Riders have had a little bit of recent success with guys coming straight out of JUCO with a receiver we all know and love in Ajo Ajo. This could be a similar story if Deion Smith wants to come up to Canada to try and prove he can make the jump directly from the CFL to the NFL. This is a name to watch if you're a Rider fan.
And do you know where Holmes Community College is? I have no idea.
I don't off the top of my head. I don't know where any JUCOs are. Usually they're in the middle of nowhere.
Dunk can Google it. I'm going to read out Hodge's heritage moment. We are keeping this segment as well. On this day in 1989, Edmonton defeated the Calgary Stampeders by a score of 54-4, marking the first of three times the team would hold its opponent to less than 10 points in a game. Edmonton's defense would set a new record at the end of the year after allowing just 302 points. That's 16.8 per game, the fewest ever over an 18-game season. JC, do you think we'll ever see a team give up fewer than 16.8 points per game in the CFL again?
I don't think we will. We're in a different era when it comes to defense. The rules are slanted in the offense's favor. I think those days are long past.
Fellas, for the record, Holmes Community College in a fun town, Goodman, Mississippi. That's where it's located.
Goodman, Mississippi. All
What's
right.
the population of Goodman, Mississippi?
Well, one less.
Really
when,
testing me.
It'll Goodman, be one Mississippi. Less when Deion Smith comes back up to Canada.
There we go. It's a population of 1,258 as of the last available census.
There you go. Guys, Regina will be a burgeoning metropolis.
To him, it will be. Well, where's my segment? JC's got one. Hodge's got one.
Anytime we talk about Canadian quarterbacks, this is your segment.
Fair. Let's go to the three-minute drill. BC Lions defensive back Deontay Williams was fined for spearing an opponent in week six. Does he play too physically?
I don't want to say too physically, but I think he should, if for no other reason than, I mean, obviously player safety, but then saving his money, I think he should try to play maybe just a little bit more in the lines. JC, you spoke to Roy Leister, who recently won the CFL's Kick for a Million contest. The 77-year-old retiree said his knowledge of the CFL is, quote, very limited, and that he's more of a Blue Jays fan. I'm sure the CFL office loved him saying that to the media. Can you believe that?
I can. It's going to be fun to see him back to a CFL game for the first time in 30 years next week when he comes to the BC Lions versus Hamilton Tiger Cats game. I just will say for the record, Hodge, he didn't win Kick for a Million. He won million-dollar touchdown to win. Kick for a Million is a different contest, which is now Kick for 500,000, I've learned, based on the CFL's social media page. Shrinkflation is even affecting legendary CFL contests. Rough Riders running back Kadeem Carey appeared to suffer a devastating leg injury in Vancouver this past week. Dunk, do you think his season is over?
Yeesh. You know, I don't like to put timelines on injuries because you never know, and neither does Corey Mace. And I doubt he'll say with certainty when he provides an update that Carey's season is over, but that did not look good, fellas. You know, my first thought was, is Kadeem Carey's career potentially over? I hope that it's not. Hopefully it's much less worse than what it looked on the field. But my goodness, man, Godspeed to him and whatever recovery he's going to have to go through. Longtime Winnipeg Blue Bombers kicker Troy Westwood is being inducted into the Manitoba Sports Hall of Fame. Worthy selection, right?
I couldn't believe he wasn't in already. Like, Troy Westwood not only played for the Blue Bombers forever, he's from Dauphin, Manitoba. Like, he was born in the province. He set records for the team. I think he's fourth all-time in CFL scoring. I can't believe it took this long. AJ Ouellette recently teased his former Ohio University teammate Nathan Rourke, calling him, quote, a freaking nerd, close quote. JC, do you consider Rourke to be a nerd?
Let me put it this way. I wouldn't be shocked if he wears a pocket protector underneath his jersey. Yes, Nathan Rourke is a nerd. But in the immortal words of Travis Kelce, you want your quarterback to have a little bit of nerd in him. That's why Nathan Rourke works so hard at his job, is because he absolutely nerds out over football. Bo Levi Mitchell is officially a top 10 all-time CFL passer after surpassing Tracy Ham during Sunday's win over the Red Blacks. How high can Bo go on the list?
You know, realistically, if you look at it, I think potentially this season, fellas, he could pass Matt Dunnigan for eighth all-time. Dunnigan currently at 43,857 yards. So if Bo continues on this pace, he'll pass Dunnigan. The next question is, how many years is Bo Levi Mitchell going to continue to play? And if he's throwing for 5,000 yards and looking as good as he has through the first six games with the Ticats this season, perhaps it's multiple years that he continues to play, because you look at Ron Lancaster, who's in seventh, 50,535 yards. Kevin Glenn is number six, 52,867 yards. Danny McManus is fifth with 53,255 yards. So those guys could potentially be in range. And then if you're getting inside the top five, we're talking about Ricky Ray over 60,000 yards, Henry Burris over 63,000, Damon Allen over 72,000, and then Anthony Calville almost 80,000. Bo Levi Mitchell told me in the offseason leading into 2025 that at one point in his career, he sat down and did the math and thought, oh, ho-hum, like, I'll catch Anthony Calville if I play this many years and throw for this many yards. But then he went, oh my God, like, that is an insane amount. So I think realistically, he could get to eighth this year. And if he plays a couple more seasons, I think he could have a shot at cracking the top five. Hodge, you were present for Milt Stegall's much anticipated return to Winnipeg. What was that moment like being inside the stadium for it?
Oh, it was incredible. I also went and spoke with Milt before the game. Wished him well, gave him a hug. He seems to be doing absolutely great considering the unbelievable circumstances. He talked about Chase. He also did great interviews locally with Paul Friesen and Jeff Hamilton. I'd encourage everybody to check out those articles. They're linked in my post-gamer from this past weekend. Winnipeg loves Milt Stegall, and I don't think that could be understated. If he ran for mayor tomorrow, he'd win, regardless of platform. And Milt Stegall, I honestly believe, loves Winnipeg just as much as Winnipeg loves him. Like, this is a guy who has said on record, you know, Cincinnati's where I was born, Atlanta's where I live, but Winnipeg is my home. And that cheer, I think, was designed to take place specifically after the land acknowledgement at Princess Auto Stadium, but before O Canada, so they could cut it off. Like, I counted. It went for exactly a minute, and it actually got louder as the minute went on. I've got a full video up of it on my Twitter account if anybody wants to watch it. And it only stopped because the stadium announcer said, it is now time for O Canada. And I appreciate that the Bombers and TSN and everybody has a strict schedule for what they can allow, right? They can't have a 12-minute standing ovation before the game starts. That throws everything off. But I do wonder how long that cheer would have gone, because I don't think it was even half over by the time it got chopped. But I thought it was touching. Milt said afterwards, releasing a statement saying that is the number one moment for him now in Winnipeg, which is pretty remarkable considering he became the CFL's touchdown leader in Winnipeg. His second child was born in Winnipeg. So yeah, Milt, I can't say enough about him as a person. Unbelievably gracious. And yes, he can be brash and talk about his ego, but I actually think Milt is a really humble person, a lot of humility, an unimaginable amount of grace, emotional intelligence. And I was thrilled, not just for him getting to see that love, but also I think fans in Winnipeg wanting to offer their love, wanting to offer their support and getting an opportunity to do that in person at a sold out stadium. That was the highlight of the game for me. Didn't really matter what happened in the 60 minutes after that. It was just awesome to be able to behold that. And it wasn't by design, by the way, as well. Milta said he didn't come back this week because he wanted to be in Winnipeg. He decided this is the right time. And then TSN's producers were like, oh, that works out well. The panel's in Winnipeg. And Milt was like, oh, even better. So he didn't come back specifically for this opportunity, but this opportunity lined up perfectly. And I think it was great for all parties involved. And just to say it here, I've said it to your face as well, Milt, but we're here for you. We love you. Everybody in the CFL does. And we wish you all the best. On that note, we thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. For Jerry Seinfeld and Kramer, I am George. We'll see you next week for our next episode.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.